Bagthorpe's Abroad, Chapter 15. This is not a LibriVox recording. It's a Henry recording. 3 and 4, who were not so local as 1 and 2, and were certainly not related to the Bagthorpe's absentee landlord, looked about the kitchen in bewilderment. Nice place you've got here, sir, said 3 to Mr. Bagthorpe, assuming him to be the owner. It is not nice, he replied curtly, and it is not mine. Rented, explained 1 quickly. Ideal holiday home, and haunted. Haunted? Repeated 4 with evident interest. Oh, indubitably, 1 assured him. The smell of garlic strengthened. Mrs. Fosdyke, fearing another seance, was digging her nails into her bulb again. I think we should confine ourselves to facts, proclaimed Grandma loudly. I think we should make sworn statements. Is there a Bible in the house? At this, something slotted into place in Mrs. Fosdyke's jigsaw of a memory. "Here," she said, "it's just come to me. We should have had a Bible before." They all looked at her. "They always do," she explained. "What you do, you have a cross round your neck, and garlic in the windows and everywhere, and a Bible. You've got to take proper precautions." 1 and 2, who had been hoping that the subject of the seance would not come up in the presence of their colleagues, coughed uncomfortably. "You've been calling up!" It was 4, in a hoarse, excited tone, eyes glittering. "Calling up, have you?" "Not properly," Tess told him. "It was all too makeshift. I am the only one who takes it seriously." "Ah, indeed, it must be taken seriously," agreed 4, who seemed quite to have forgotten that he was an officer of the law conducting a preliminary inquiry. "And you called up without a Bible?" He sounded as shocked as if he had been informed that they had intended to make a live sacrifice. He shook his head, long and hard. "I saw the name on the gate," he said, with an air of deep significance. There seemed no obvious rejoinder to this, and no one spoke. "Tai Silian Duan!" He rolled the words off his tongue with relish. He sounded rather like Dylan Thomas reading one of his own poems. "Tai Silian Duan!" "So what?" demanded Mr. Bagthorpe rudely. "House of Black Corners!" His voice dropped. "House of Black Corners!" This, as far as the Bagthorpes were concerned, was a turn-up for the book. Nobody had had the time, let alone the inclination, to translate. Now they were momentarily awed. The name certainly had a distinctly sinister ring. "Black Corners!" came a disgusted voice. "Black Corners! There's more than corners black in this house, top to bottom, front to back. It'll be all of 6 weeks before it's put to rights. I've never in all my born days!" On she rambled. Mrs. Fosdyke's mind was not conspicuously poetic or symbolic. To her, a black corner was, quite literally, a black corner. And she did, in fact, have a point. "Are all the corners black, do you think?" asked Rosie in a small voice. "Even in our bedrooms?" "There!" exclaimed Tess triumphantly. "It proves my point. The house is on a black ley line. It's more than likely on a meeting of black ley lines. The presences in this house will not be pleasant." At this, Grandma suddenly remembered that she had brought her Bible with her, and sent Jack up to her room to fetch it. "It is in the far corner by the window," she told him, "and has a photograph of darling Thomas the First on it, and a bunch of dandelions." Just as Mrs. Fosdyke had her portable pantry, so Grandma evidently had her portable shrine. "Come on, Zero," Jack told him, thinking that he would then have a reliable ghost detector in the shape of Zero's fur. "Put all the lights on while you're up there, won't you?" begged Rosie. All this talk of black corners and apparitions was making most of the Bagthorpes jumpy. "I am very interested in the supernatural," 4 confided. "I have the sight. Runs in the family, see." "Look," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "we are not interested in your hobbies, nor those of your next of kin. Our interest in the matter is purely scientific. We are engaged in research." Here there was quite a long silence while 4 drew himself up to his not very considerable height. "Finalist," he said in distant tones. "Finalist. Mastermind. Special subject. The life and work of Dennis Wheatley." "Ooh!" exclaimed Mrs. Fosdyke admiringly, enchanted to meet a fellow devotee in so unlikely a context. "There, you see, he'll know all about the garlic." "Garlic," said Four. "Certainly, garlic is of the essence." "You can say that again," remarked Uncle Parker, wrinkling his nose fastidiously. "Those that can't stand the garlic," Mr. Bagthorpe told him, "can get out of the kitchen. Ha!" "Were you really a finalist in Mastermind?" asked William, impressed. "That means your general knowledge must be good. Oh, it must be a game show." "Father once tried to get on that," Rosie told him. "He chose the life and work of Emily Bronte because she only wrote one novel and some poems, but he didn't score one single point on general knowledge. Can you believe it? Not one!" "I told you the questions were rigged," Mr. Bagthorpe snapped. "They always are. They're rigged so that a gravedigger can win, or a dustman, or a milk roundsman." "He didn't even know who invented the telephone," Rosie went on. She started to giggle. "He said Einstein, and when they asked him what a Rhode Island Red was, he said... Here she collapsed into helpless giggles. Mr. Bagthorpe had replied that it was a brand of apples, like a Golden Delicious, and had even argued about it when told this answer was wrong. He found this discussion of his general knowledge, or rather lack of it, deeply mortifying, and was about to change the subject when Four did so for him. "When we have the Bible, I will call," he said. "Whom are we calling?" A small child weeping, a bearded man carrying a candle, a veiled lady, a ring of blue fire emitting... Tess ticked the list of apparitions off on her fingers. "I should just call a couple," William told him. "If all the corners in this place are black, there could be dozens of 'em lurking. We don't want the whole shooting match coming out of their corners." "Ah, Jack, dear, thank you," exclaimed Grandma. She snatched the Bible from his hands, held it aloft, and rattled off. "I swear by Almighty God that the evidence I shall give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. I wish to testify to Daisy's innocence." "You realize, don't you, that she's still out there?" said Jack. No one took the slightest notice of him. They all assumed that Daisy had shot her bolt for the night. She had achieved plenty, even by her own exacting standards. They set about arguing whether they should hold a séance or an inquiry, or both. One and Two were in favor of holding a very quick inquiry, and then getting off the premises with the utmost speed possible. Mrs. Fosdyke had changed her position about the séance, and now wanted one, secure in the knowledge that a Dennis Wheatley buff would know how to deploy the garlic properly, and take the necessary precautions to prevent Old Nick himself being inadvertently raised. It was Four, clearly ecstatic at having come upon what he took to be a whole family of fellow psychics, who carried the day. He had his heart set on an immediate séance, and, now that he had his Bible, started organizing it at once. "Do we have any non-believers?" he asked, in sepulchral tones. Nobody wished to admit this, largely because they suspected that if they did so they would be ejected from the meeting. They did not feel that they could cope with whatever the black corners threw up all alone, and without benefit of Bible and garlic. "I think Mother should leave the room," said Mr. Bagthorpe. "She is out to sabotage me." "I think that we should hold the inquiry first," said Grandma, not troubling to deny this allegation. "I have now sworn my oath."
"For what it is worth," put in Mr. Bagthorpe.
"I think we ought not to have an inquiry until I have rigged up a lie detector," Tess said.
"Until you have what?" demanded Mr. Bagthorpe.
For her last birthday, Tess had asked for and received a biofeedback device. She used it, she said, to assist her meditation, but she also claimed that it doubled as a lie detector. This involved electrical wires being taped to the subjects, and so far nobody had accepted Tess's invitation to act as guinea pig. "I have no wish to be fried alive, thank you," Mr. Bagthorpe had told her, and this more or less summed up the general sentiment. The line between fact and fiction was in any case more than a little blurred for most of the family. They would be poor subjects for a lie detector.
"I could not take part in any inquiry in which it was even hinted that I might tell an untruth," said Grandma piously. "I merely wish to testify to darling Daisy's innocence."
"The spirits are abroad already. I feel them. I hear them."
Four was now well into his stride, and clearly not to be robbed of his séance.
"You have called already, and they have stirred. They have arisen from their black corners, and await my bidding."
"Have they really, do you think?"
Rosie whispered anxiously to Jack.
"I don't know," he whispered back, "but don't worry. There are plenty of us. We'll outnumber them."
"Not if there's one in every corner, we won't. That'll be..."
She began to make rapid mental calculations. "Four bedrooms, four... Do landings count, do you think? And the bathroom?"
"We will form a circle," Four was saying, "and I, with the Bible, will take the center." Things were moving fast.
"It'll be more than 40," whispered Rosie desperately. "Oh, Jack, I'm scared."
"Here's some garlic, officer," Mrs. Fosdyke said generously, passing him several crushed cloves. The whole room was beginning to smell like a salad dressing.
"Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, I've just remembered something," Rosie shrieked.
"What, dear?" asked her mother.
"The reports! You haven't opened our reports yet!"
"So we haven't," exclaimed Mrs. Bagthorpe. "Did you hear that, Henry? We haven't opened the children's reports."
She was evidently herself anxious to postpone the moment when the lights went out again. She had been on the point of suggesting that they have a sing-song when Rosie had spoken up. Mrs. Bagthorpe had in the past had several very worrying problems from people who had dabbled in the supernatural. They had all sounded unhinged, if not downright mad, and she did not wish to see her own family move any further in this direction.
"Hell's bells, Laura," expostulated her husband. "You are surely not seriously suggesting—"
"I'll go and get them. They're in my bag. They're in the hall."
Rosie jumped to her feet.
"I don't think there ought to be talk of hell and such," came Mrs. Fosdyke's doom-laden voice. "Not at a time like this, I don't."
Rosie reached the door and flung it open. As she did so, there came the deafening blast of a police siren, or even two police sirens. The doorway jammed as all present fought to get out. In the event, only one, two, Rosie and Mrs. Fosdyke were in time to witness the crash, as the second squad car, Daisy energetically turning the wheel, rolled back to meet a third police car, rounding the bend in the drive at speed. There was an almighty bang. Mr. Bagthorpe shoved unceremoniously to the front and stared wild-eyed at the scene before him. Three blue lights played frenetically over the wreckage. Two police radios crackled and screamed. Two dazed officers staggered from their mangled vehicle. In the back of the original police car, Grandpa was still sitting with the beatific smile of a man who has just seen his dearest wish come true.
"I said so," came Mrs. Fosdyke's lugubrious tones. "Didn't I say so? Things always go in threes."
Mr. Bagthorpe began to sneeze.
The second day of the Bagthorpe's holiday was taken up with police interviews, mainly. Many and lengthy statements had to be made, and even at the end of the day, no very clear picture of the events of the previous night emerged. This was because most of the statements, though all, naturally, were signed and sworn as being true, were conflicting. Mr. Bagthorpe blamed Daisy Parker, and by implication Uncle Parker, and the police themselves. There was no need, he asserted, for them to descend at dead of night on a quiet holiday-making family, as if they had been tipped off that someone was running drugs or plotting the assassination of the Prime Minister. Uncle Parker, Grandma, Rosie, and Daisy herself held Daisy to be totally innocent. This was an almost impossible position to take, given that Daisy had single-handedly dented one police car and written off two others, but they took it anyway. Everybody else blamed Daisy Parker and her goat, though Mrs. Bagthorpe was held to be not a very reliable witness because she had been suffering from shock at the time, having just had about 2 gallons of rainwater squeezed over her. Matters were further complicated by the arrival at Tysilion-Douan of Aunt Celia, dressed as if she were going to a fancy dress party as the Lady of Shalott. She certainly acted as if a curse had come upon her, though she did not, fortunately, faint. She was highly strung at the best of times, not to say unstable, as Mr. Bagthorpe did say, and a generous dose of cold water administered by Mrs. Fosdyke would probably have finished her off. Aunt Celia was certainly very soulful, but she must also have had a modicum of native cunning, because she went all out to enlist the sympathy and support of the police. This was not difficult, because she was ravishingly beautiful, and could also, seemingly at will, weep large, glistening tears that rolled appealingly down her cheeks without making either her eyes or nose red. "Spare a thought for a mother's grief," she entreated. "Do not blight a mother's life."
Grandma used more straightforward tactics, namely blackmail.
I should imagine that the chief constable of this county would be much interested to hear that 2 out of 3 of the crashes took place while the officers concerned were playing parlor games," she told them. "I should not be surprised," she went on, "if the Home Secretary would not be interested to learn this. It is, I take it, no part of an officer's brief to raise spirits from the dead while on duty." Here she had 4 of the 6 policemen floored. Grandma had a very nice line in cross-examination. She got this partly from all the police serials she watched on television, and partly from years of practice in the inquests and post-mortems regularly held by the Bagthorpes themselves. The police would have gladly washed their hands of the whole affair, had this been feasible, and dropped their inquiries. Unfortunately, the mangled state of their vehicles made this impossible. Grandma's own sworn statement would, if believed by their superiors, get them all severely reprimanded, if not actually drummed out of the force. In it, she alleged that officers 1 and 2 had invited Daisy to play with their car and shown her how the radio worked, and that 3 and 4 had refused to leave the house until they had raised a spirit. She also said that the 3rd police car had come up the drive at 90 miles an hour. She rounded off her statement by alleging that the police had intimidated a minor, namely Daisy. Mrs. Fosdyke's statement was extremely diffuse. She saw her chance to report all Daisy's previous misdemeanors, going back years. When the police weekly pointed out that Daisy's setting fire to Grandma's birthday party had no bearing on the present case, she argued with them. "Criminals always have a long list of things they've done previous," she told them. "They ask the judge to take 'em into account. I do read the papers, you know." You're going to pick all that up, right? Thank you. The real reason, of course, was that Mrs. Fosdyke found it very therapeutic to list all Daisy's crimes on a police form. She had longed to do this for years, and was now determined that Daisy's police record should be as comprehensive as possible. She also gave at great length her own opinion of Daisy and her character. "It's facts we want," 3 told her, "not opinions." This cut no ice with Mrs. Fosdyke, who saw no distinction between the two. By the time the statements were completed, all involved were feeling extremely jaded. The Bagthorpes gathered in the porch to watch the last breakdown truck winching up a police vehicle. The dispirited police made their departure. "Come and play another time!" Daisy squealed after them. And there the scene freezes. There is never really an ideal moment to pause for a while in the telling of the Bagthorpe saga. Natural breaks are few and far between, climaxes commonplace. We leave the Bagthorpes and their victims locked in tableau, eerily moveless and silent, and behind them the looming shadow of the House of Black Corners. The secrets of those corners, and much else besides, including the tracking down of Daisy's goat, must await the unfolding of yet another grisly chapter of the Bagthorpe saga. End of Bagthorpes Abroad, read for Henry by Kara in August of 2007. Good night, Henry.